Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Aparna Gopalan, and today we will be talking about the new book, Landscapes of Accumulation, Real Estate and the Neoliberal Imagination in Contemporary India, which came out with the University of Chicago Press in 2015. The book was authored by Professor Irena Searle, who is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Rochester. Few who have visited India in the past few decades will have failed to notice the sudden and spectacular urban transformation that has taken place in many of its cities. Gated residential complexes with tennis courts and indoor gyms, glitzy office buildings, gleaming five-star hotels, and of course, air-conditioned malls have become ubiquitous as the face of a new India, often understood as symbols of a long-awaited global modernity. Getting behind this glitzy facade, Professor Searle shows that these buildings are not built to service consumer India. They are built for real estate developers, international investors, for whom Indian real estate has become a profitable speculative gamble. Indian land and buildings are no longer local resources for production or use. They are turning, or more accurately, being turned, into internationally tradable financial assets. How this happens, by whose effort, and against what frictions, is the story the book tells. Searle shows that it is through the narrative of a rising Indian middle class that investments are solicited and a real estate boom created. Through ethnographic attention to the practices and labors of real estate producers, Searle offers an innovative, sophisticated, and refreshingly human story of the making of neoliberal India, a story that ultimately shows that the new landscapes that are cropping up all over India are landscapes first and foremost of accumulation. This book will be of interest to readers in urban studies, economics, anthropology, and of course, South Asian studies. I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Searle about her book. Here's my interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
Professor Searle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
To begin, could you tell us a little bit about how you came to be an anthropologist and how you came to be an anthropologist interested particularly in real estate and in North India?
I guess there's a number of different things that came together in this project. First, I guess I'm the daughter of landscape architects, so I've always been interested in landscapes. I've always been interested in the built environment and sort of training an eye on the world around us. My undergraduate degree was in art history, and I did a fair amount of architectural history. So as I began visiting India, and I had made numerous visits before kind of beginning graduate school, I was always looking at the built environment and really interested in Indian cities and how they had changed and the sort of the historical trajectory and all of that. But as I was here over time, I noticed it's very hard to miss places like Gurgaon that had come up. And I was really interested in sort of why this place, why these kind of glass encased, particularly globally oriented buildings. Why were they coming up here? Who was designing them, etc.? And so that really just sort of started my questioning. I actually began graduate school in urban geography. because of my interest in place and cities. But I was then drawn to anthropology because of the methodology, and I really wanted to learn how to do ethnography. And I felt that capturing people's own experiences and point of view would be necessary to understand what's going on. And in particular, at that time, there wasn't a lot in urban geography that actually, where people had actually talked to real estate developers. It was sort of a black box. So people talked about the effects of urbanization or the effects of gentrification, kind of things happening in the city, but primarily talking to residents. And so it was kind of like this, I don't know, these sort of bad guys who were never given a face or a voice. And I felt that with the tools of anthropology, perhaps I could get inside the world of real estate production to understand sort of how it worked. So that's sort of how I came to this topic. And even initially, even with that kind of understanding, I still was very much interested, I think this is my art history background, in talking with architects and trying to understand the design of these buildings. And I quickly realized that I shouldn't really think in that way about the buildings, that really these buildings were financial tools. They were ways that people were making money, and that was the driving factor here. And that architects, for example, weren't necessarily being paid very well, or they never finished drawing. So the buildings didn't necessarily represent architects' vision, although to some extent they did. But I shouldn't take like a traditional anthropological approach, was to think about, which would be to think about the spaces that buildings create and the kinds of social interactions that they foster. But I really didn't need to kind of change my mindset and think about them as financial tools. And so that's how I got into sort of studying even more in terms of the financial flows that were producing these kinds of landscapes.
Thank you for that answer. That definitely is something that is so rare about your book. One reads so much about financialization of land, and yet one never really hears from, you know, these private sector elites that you talk to. And you do describe, as you started to, some of the reasons that you thought it was important to pay attention to these groups of elites, because, you know, we can't get the full picture by looking at consumers or residents. But you also talked in the introduction of your book about some of the challenges that you encountered in studying this group. So could you tell us a bit more about those sort of methodological challenges for an anthropologist, as an anthropologist studying, you know, investors and developers?
Yeah, I mean, I think every anthropologist faces these kinds of challenges, but just slightly different ones, right? So that one's positionality, who you are and your social position, then shapes your access to informants. And in this particular case, my positionality as a young white American woman and a student really didn't help me in gaining the rapport of these men, because it was primarily men, as sort of male-dominated industry. Both the foreign private equity and other real estate investors who were working in the market, they were primarily men, and the Indian real estate developers were also primarily men. So it's just like lots of men, patriarchal society. I was young, I was foreign, I was a woman. So these things just didn't really lend themselves to kind of easy rapport. And I think the other thing is that I underestimated going into it, the challenges of studying up. I mean, this has actually been well documented, and other people have faced these issues as well. But being on a graduate student stipend and yet trying to sort of fit in at industry events where, you know, I didn't have the right kind of cell phone, I didn't come in a car with a driver. I didn't really have the sort of accoutrement to allow myself to fit in. And for the most part, that was fine. But then occasionally, you know, doing the field work, it actually did, like, there were places I couldn't go because I didn't have the money to gain access. And there were also plenty of people who, you know, the market was really booming. So my informants were all extremely busy. And I don't blame them, but they didn't really see what value could come from chatting with me. And a lot of what they were working on, you know, it's the information was valuable to could make or break deals. So they didn't want to share that with me. And no one really wanted me to sit in as they were making deals, which also I totally understand that in this, you know, kind of high stakes game of making connections and, you know, buying land and signing on partners, that they didn't need to have a kind of unexplained presence at the table. So doing a kind of traditional ethnography where I was like fully enmeshed in people's lives was a little bit tricky. You know, also for example, the socializing that these folks did was tricky for me to do as a young woman, given that it was such a kind of male sociality that I just really didn't have access to. So, I mean, those things were all there. I did eventually kind of connect with a European real estate development fund, and they let me sort of hang out in their office a bit, and that was really helpful. And through them, I made a lot of contacts, even if I don't write that much about kind of what the day-to-day life of the office, that was very helpful. But, you know, a lot of my work was, I think, necessarily interview-driven based on documents as much as it was ethnography. Although, I mean, obviously, every event that I could attend and every moment that I could possibly kind of insert myself in, I tried. But, you know, it was a sort of challenging industry to take part in.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but you definitely managed to sort of get a lot out of, you know, your informants as well as the documents. So the first half of your book in particular focuses on the work that is done by what you call the India story in creating the real estate boom that you were witnessing and in general in sort of a financializing space in the national capital region. So what is the India story? Who's telling it? Who's the audience? And what are some of the ways in which it acts as what you call speculative knowledge?
Sure. So this is something that I think even as an anthropologist, I was surprised in doing this work about the power of stories. So my informants actually referred to the India story as the India story. Like this was a title, a term that they used. To mean this idea that India was about to kind of come into its own as a global player, that India was poised, like China, to kind of grow exponentially. This is a time of high GDP growth, but it was more than just economic growth, right? There's a sort of social vision here that Indian consumer society is growing, so incomes are going to go up, so there's going to be so many more consumers in India, that it's a young population that's growing. And in real estate, an idea that those young people are going to form nuclear families, so they're going to want lots of individual apartments, that they're going to be able to afford expensive apartments, that thus prices are going to be up. It's sort of a way of talking about both a real estate market and a society that would make a good place to invest and build and sell real estate. The story has many sort of tentacles, but it was told, I mean, it was sort of one of those overwhelming things where everyone I talked to used almost the same language to describe what was happening. And that I found really, really fascinating, that there would be such coherence among different people in their description of India, Indian society, Indian economy, and Indian real estate. So, you know, I write about this as a story that people told themselves and helped to shape the decisions they made, investment decisions, construction decisions, and also a story that, for example, Indians were telling to foreigners in order to draw the money into Indian real estate, because Indian real estate, the industry had just been liberalized. So this meant that for the first time in 2005, it was possible to invest from outside into Indian real estate. Now, there were various regulations that shaped how that investment could happen, but that meant that there were, partly because of the global monetary situation at that time, but there were a lot of investors from Malaysia, Singapore, Europe, America, et cetera, who were very much interested in putting their money into Indian real estate. But part of that interest, I'm arguing, comes from the repetition of these stories, you know, and they have many origins, which I try to trace. So some of the early chapters of the book, I'm kind of tracing out, you know, something that I heard an informant say. Could I find a report that actually used that same phrase or statistic? Could I see it in the newspapers? Could I see it, you know, how could I trace its circulation as best I could? And many of these stories come back to the BRICS reports that Goldman Sachs put out, which argued that Brazil, Russia, India, and China would soon overtake the traditional, like, sort of Western Europe in terms of GDP and economic growth. And I looked at the way that then that those reports got picked up by the Indian media and the Indian business media, and then find their way into the kinds of investor prospectuses that Indian real estate developers and others were putting together to try to draw an investment. And then, but I also traced the story in how people were talking about price appreciation and how people were thinking about Indian consumers. So I look a lot at these other kinds of consultancy reports and investor presentations and just really trace through this story's many sort of iterations and then think about it. Also, you know, there are a lot of predictions about what's going to happen in the future, right? The India story is a future-oriented story. And I argue that instead of thinking about whether this is true or not, the whole point of this kind of predictive story is to think about what work it does. So how does it help? How do people telling the story use that to position themselves in particular ways and use that to attract investment or sell apartments or increase their market share? So thinking about these stories as doing work, interactive work for people in the industry, and thus, you know, tracing their circulation in those, trying to capture that in those interactive moments and think about its movement and its power that way as it's involved in these various value projects of the different people that I was interviewing.
I feel like the India story's full gravity sort of came through for me, especially in the conclusion where you go back, you know, to Gurgaon to find that the rental apartment market has crashed because there have been too many apartments produced and the consumers who were sort of predicted to materialize didn't. And so it seems like one of the key features of this kind of the India story and this kind of future-centric temporality of your informants is that it does generate sort of immediate profits, but it seems like in the long run, it's unsustainable, you know, even for themselves. So ultimately, who benefits from the India story? And what are some of the enduring effects of the India story that sort of outlast, you know, market booms and busts?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think, as you say, like, the India story had very good short-term effects for the people telling it often, right? They were able to float an initial a public offer on the stock exchange, or they were unable to make a partnership or to sell some buildings. In some senses, that's, for my informants, that's all that mattered, right? It was, they talked about long-term investment and a long-term future. They talked about a long temporality in part to reassure other people that this wasn't speculation. So that was a concern, and I would even say an anxiety of my informants, is to talk about sort of market fundamentals and solidity and long-term growth. But really, people were quite focused on that short-term gain. But as you say, right, that this was speculative, and there just aren't enough people in India who could afford the kinds of apartments that were being built. And so part of my interest in speculation in the India story, right, is to think about why were these buildings being built in the first place if it's fairly clear that there just aren't enough wealthy people to buy them. So even if it produces you know, so in the long term, even if there is a market bust, or, you know, they don't sell as many apartments, or many of these real estate developers got into an incredible amount of debt, and many of them are kind of mired in lawsuits. And right now there's just, you know, many more apartments, for example, in Gurgaon outside of Delhi than can be sold. So you're right. The boom did precipitate a bust, and obviously many people made losses, but people also, sold and bought land, you know, so it was productive. It just might not have been productive in the ways that people had hoped. And some people certainly made out very well through this. I would say, though, that, like, overall, this story helps to, I saw it as a kind of alibi, which enabled people to real estate developers, real estate producers, to produce buildings for wealthy elites in a country that is full of people who are not wealthy elites, right? So it enabled a kind of capture of resources for the elites with this kind of thin veneer of the kind of predictive and future-oriented quality, which sort of said, soon India will look just like, you know, name your Western country or more developed place, like, you know, soon Gurgaon will look just like Singapore, was a way for people to, an alibi that people used in order to build these very swanky elite places. And in fact, to capture that land from farmers, from poor people living in cities whose homes were demolished to make way for this. So it was a way to, or it served to disenfranchise the poor and enrich elites, even if later there was a bust and, you know, not all the apartments sold and that sort of.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that for me was one of the most important contributions of your book. Early in the book, you discuss, you know, there's a lot of scholarship recently on accumulation by dispossession, but a lot more attention has been paid to the dispossession aspect of things than the accumulation and the forging of the roots of accumulation. And that comes through, like, even in the title of your book. So I thought that was sort of such an important insight that even when markets come and go, you know, the forging and the sort of making of these enduring relationships and these sort of roots of accumulation that stays and maybe even enables, you know, future projects, value projects. So thank you for that. I really loved that, you know, that framing. So in the second half of your book, you sort of switch gears a little bit and you talk about Indian real estate developers and foreign investors as these two groups who want to work together to profit from real estate. But there's all these difficulties and it takes a lot of work for them to work together. And you say that foreign investment is not just about moving money, but it's about making Indian firms and Indian buildings investable. So what does that mean, and how is it accomplished?
Yeah, I was really struck doing the field work by how much work it was taking in order to move money, right? That this wasn't some sort of like instantaneous flash finance, just kind of, it's just zeros and ones, and it just moves quickly through the international financial system, but that my informants were doing a lot of work. And a lot of that work actually was this kind of image work, right? So it was about convincing other people. So for example, if you're a private real estate investment fund and you put together all of this money from various investors around the world and it's in a fund and you've come to India and you want to invest it, before you are able to do some kind of tie-up with an Indian company. So you can invest it either in a construction project or in an Indian company at the corporate level, and then it would flow into the various construction projects that they have, that they're doing. So you either have to make that particular investment, like the construction project or the corporation, look like something you would want to invest in, right? And so people are doing research and they're trying to work out where should we invest that money, which of the many, many Indian developers is a company that's trustworthy, that's doing good work, that has a, you know, profitable business model, et cetera. And they're doing all of that research. But in so doing, and then also in communicating back to, you know, an investment board that might be sitting in New York or in London, they also need to, I guess in some ways, kind of either gloss over or fix many of the problems that, from an investor point of view, they see in the way that Indian real estate is being done. So from their point of view, you know, they have a very different model for how real estate should progress, what construction would look like, what finished buildings, in fact, should look like. You know, from their point of view, you know, there were buildings all over India, obviously, but from an investor point of view, there was no investable buildings, which meant that they also felt that many of the construction projects that were coming up were also not investable, which meant they didn't like the floor plans, they didn't like the facades, they didn't like the kind of infrastructure that would be there in the building. And so they were trying to influence all of that to find buildings that they thought would make good investments. And then they also didn't like much of what they saw about the companies. A lot of Indian real estate development companies were fairly small outfits that were organized as family-run firms. And the way that they had done business in the past in India and actually continue to do business was what investors would think of as informal. So a lot of cash payments, a lot of connections with politicians in order to get land and approvals. They often, real estate, you know, banks in India would not lend to real estate developers before about the mid-90s. So many of these developers had developed other ways of financing their projects. Often they, you know, for residential projects and people, they still do this, they would have potential buyers buy in before the project was built. And as that money came in, they would, you know, that people would pay in installments. And as the money came in, they would build the building. But they would also have wealthy friends invest. So all these various kinds of informal financing. And so for, you know, for an investment board sitting outside of India, all of this looked incredibly shady. It looked not very trustworthy. It looked, you know, they didn't conform, right, to the kind of expectations of these investors. And so I look at the conflicts that emerge over this and the real pressures that these investors were putting on their potential partners to change the way that they did accounting, to change the way that the head of the company organized his company and his labor, the way he, you know, even dressed or spoke. So there was a lot of pressure that they were placing in order to, with, you know, and holding out the carrot of, right, well, like, if you do all these changes in your corporation, we will we will fund you by X amount of money. And many Indian developers were happy to do this, but there was a kind of cachet, right? A kind of prestige that came from having an international investor. And so many corporations did, and real estate developers did to a certain extent conform to these norms.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, but you also sort of very interestingly point out that this put developers, Indian developers, in a sort of double bind, because they both had to sort of make themselves and their firms look transparent. And at the same time, the actual work of acquiring land through all the bureaucratic marshes and dealing with, you know, individual landowners was always a very murky business. And that I thought was really interesting that, you know, this is an industry that demands transparency, and yet transparency is pretty much impossible in the work that they want done.
Yeah. And, you know, this word transparent was just one that came up all the time in my interviews and in my conversations, and you know, the events that I went to, that's the term that that foreign investors would use, that, oh, India, nothing is transparent here, or Indian developers aren't very transparent, or, you know, the way the market works is murky or not transparent. And so I felt like they used that and this kind of international discourse about transparency, that transparency is a really good thing, that everyone should want it, and kind of held that out like as a way to say, you know, the way things operate here in India is no good, and we know the best way, and the best way is a transparent way. And they didn't necessarily mean like transparent as in some kind of objective measure, but transparent as in like the way we're used to things working. And so I really saw that as kind of a carrot that they held out, a term that they used in order to achieve these changes that they wanted. But at the same time, of course, you know, in order to agglomerate land, which is what a lot of the real estate developers were doing, what their main role here was, you know, what a lot of the Indian real estate developers, what their kind of role in this process became was as a land agglomerator. So they were the ones who put together the large parcels that could have this kind of large scale greenfield development that foreign investors were interested in doing, right? They're not interested in an individual house plot. They want to do a whole township. In order to, you know, land parcels are historically quite fragmented in India. And so the real estate developers would have either agglomerated land historically, or would be going out and doing this sort of right as I was doing the field work, and negotiating with individual landowners, you know, sort of family by family, village by village, and trying to buy up land and putting it together. So, you know, that process is a cash-based process. It depends on, you know, having local connections. There's an incredible amount of politics involved. And, you know, there's just no way that this is a globally legible process, right? And Indian real estate developers, in order to be successful, they needed to continue to do this work. And yet it was, as you say, a double bind, a kind of double standard, really, where the foreign investors needed them to do that work, but didn't really want to know anything about it, wanted the kind of the facade to be quote unquote transparent, even while there were, you know, sort of violent and murky things that they were doing that necessarily needed to continue to do. And, you know, some Indian real estate developers that I spoke to were actually in some ways quite proud of their prowess at navigating the really complicated political and social landscape that they needed to navigate in order to do this work. And they, you know, scoffed at these foreign investors who came in and called them, you know, like just bankers. Like, these guys don't even know what they're doing. They can't get anything done in India. What do they know? You know, I actually have a lot of expertise, and that expertise comes from the various, you know, social and political networks that I'm a part of. And so, you know, on the one hand, some of them were quite swayed by the sort of prestige of foreign investment, but others, and some at the same time, were also quite torn and resentful of the undervaluing of the kind of work that they were actually doing and needed to continue to do in order to, you know, build buildings.
Yeah, I think that really fragments our understanding of, you know, this thing called global capital or global finance, which just as just this like unitary thing, because, you know, we start to see all these sort of frictions and all these sort of debates amongst, you know, people who are all trying to engage in this thing called global finance about how to do it, and sort of these power contests between different groups like investors and developers, which each of which are trying to sort of accrue the maximum amount of value to their own expertise. And I thought one of the really interesting things you mentioned was that this conflict began to come through in Indian developers sort of saying that the value is primarily in the agglomerated land and the building doesn't matter as much. And investors sort of saying the opposite and saying that the land is not as valuable as, you know, the building we build on top of it. Could you speak a bit more about that sort of conflict between the two groups?
Yeah, you know, they really had a very different model of what real estate development was. Just, you know, the foreign investors who came in really saw the building itself, its design, the construction, as the thing that was going to generate value, because they were thinking of the building in terms of long-term leases, and leasing this out often, you know, for example, if there was a commercial building to corporate clients, many maybe multinationals. So they really thought the value came in producing exactly the kind of building that those kinds of corporates who could pay high rents would be interested in leasing. But for Indian real estate developers, there was a lot in the way that the market had worked in India that mitigated against that understanding, right? And so the really difficult part of real estate development was agglomerating all that land. It takes an incredible amount of time and connections. And that the building itself was sort of secondary, partly also because even commercial buildings in India until this point were sold, so they would be sold off to many people. So from the developer's point of view, if you're going to sell a building, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, as long as you can sell it, and sometimes even sell it in advance to investors, then it doesn't, like the layout and the construction sort of materials, et cetera, the design doesn't matter that much. What really mattered was getting all that land together to build the building. So it's just like a very different understanding of where value lay. And I saw that most where they were negotiating the cost of land. And there were a lot of conflicts over this. And the cost of land would then get translated also into sort of who got what share of whatever profits would accrue from the project. So there was quite a bit of back and forth and contention there over what shape should this project take and who should get which percentage of profits. Of course, the investors thought the developers were greedy and the developers thought the investors were greedy. And I think it came from, right, these two very different models of what real estate development was.
Yeah. You also discuss in the book that there was this debate over, you know, what is a quality building? So what is that discourse of, you know, quality, like in what way is that reflective of a conflict between investors and developers or amongst those groups?
Yeah. So in part, quality refers to, you know, the material conditions of the building, right? What materials go in, how well it's made, et cetera, et cetera. And to some extent, you could argue, right, that the very things that made the Indian real estate model, which was kind of focused on the land and not on the buildings, led to kind of poor quality buildings. But that's kind of in essence, almost exactly the argument that foreign investors would also make. And I found that they were really using that term quality, like transparency, as a way to denigrate their Indian partners, as a value project, right? As a way to say, well, we actually have the expertise to do what's needed here and to produce quote unquote quality buildings. And you guys haven't figured that out yet. So let us come in and partner with you and, you know, help you achieve this kind of success. And also what's more, you know, I found that the term quality for international investors was really more than that. It was a shorthand for talking about a certain kind of buildings for a certain kind of person. So when they say quality, often when I then ask for, so like, what's your critique of what you see as being not quality? And what they would describe is buildings that they felt actually didn't have the aesthetics to appeal to multinational corporate workers, for example. And so I found it a very interesting discourse, and I kind of traced through these various what I could term quality projects, so the quality projects of these investors who wanted to produce a specific kind of design and aesthetic qualities in the building, and then quality projects of Indian real estate developers. And I wanted to, in some ways, decenter our thinking from quality as in kind of craftsmanship or material construction of the buildings, and actually think about quality as a discourse that's really talking about aesthetics and personhood as much. At least that's the way that I was reading the way that foreign investors were talking about quality buildings or the lack of quality buildings in India. And for Indian real estate developers, you know, they were concerned about quality too, but quality meant something a little bit different. They were very concerned in a field of many, many competitors to distinguish themselves through discourses about quality. And they did so by talking about sort of their own quality, by talking about the quality of their corporations as a kind of trustworthiness. So the idea was like, we're actually going to build the building that we told you that we would. And you can see this in lots of advertisements. They show like, you know, actual construction underway, and they'd have pictures and that sort of thing, right? So it was about like kind of corporate quality. And they were very... a lot of advertisements also reference kind of ISO and other international quality ratings. So it's a way of kind of distinguishing themselves in a field of competitors. And they also, you know, the kind of global aesthetic that foreign investors were after, they were also interested in that too. And so a lot of these, you know, a lot of the, both the advertisements and the names and elements of the design of the buildings are very sort of overtly global, and they kind of are attempting to replicate this global quality register, which is what I call it, in India by, you know, naming things with English sounding names, or showing pictures of, you know, Central Park in New York in the brochure. Like that, there's this kind of overt gesture to the global as an attempt to position their buildings within this kind of imagined world of global corporate success.
Yeah, I mean, your book has definitely made it impossible for me to ever pass through Gurgaon again, you know, in any uncritical way. And I'm sure that that would be true for any reader. So thank you so much for writing this really important book that sort of intervenes in so many ways and so many literatures and commonsensical understandings. I know that you are in Delhi at the moment for research. So could you tell us a bit about what you're working on now?
Yeah. In some ways, it's an extension, and in some ways, it's a departure from the last project. While I was here, you know, I also sort of like conceptualize Indian real estate markets, right, as a series of interconnected markets, right? So there's markets in finance and markets in expertise. So think about architects. There were markets in, you know, things like mortgages and in land. And so I was thinking about kind of all these different markets coming together. And one of the markets, obviously, is media. So lots of media about homes. And in my work, I look at, you know, the, for example, the property sections of the newspapers, which is kind of a new phenomena. And, you know, the way that newspapers are selling newspapers through advertisements, property-based advertisements. And so sort of as an ancillary market, I noticed that there was a lot of advertisement and media around the elements that go into homes. So not just real estate, but lots of magazines about home decor, for example, about how to decorate your home, what kind of tile to put in, what kind of faucets and pipes and furniture to buy, what kind of paint. And that at the same time, there was a real opening up of those markets as well. So you have lots of foreign companies coming in, selling, you know, as I say, everything from paint to fixtures to furniture. Modular kitchens were something that were being advertised. And also Indian companies who were kind of retooling their image and refocusing on what they thought of as growing Indian markets for these products. So I, in my new work, I'm kind of moving inside the home. So instead of thinking about kind of how the buildings got built and how the land got sold, I'm starting to move inside and think in some similar ways about the kind of interrelations between markets and cultural and social processes by trying to work with some of these companies that or work with and study some of these companies that are selling things for inside the home, and thinking about the ways in which then the home becomes a new site of prestige and distinction for Indian elites, and also sites where inequality, for example, between homeowners and their servants are produced and reproduced in some kind of old and new ways. So yeah, the new field work that I'm working on right now is kind of working with interior designers, home decor companies, and residents in newly decorated homes.
That sounds like an excellent continuation to your first project. And, you know, I wish you all the best with it, Professor Searle, and thank you so much for being with us today.